Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Disparate Impact and the Fair Housing Act Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 21, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs v. the Inclusive Communities Project. This case involves the Fair Housing Act, which states that it is illegal to refuse to sell or rent or to refuse to negotiate for the sale or rental of or otherwise make unavailable or deny a dwelling to any person because of race. The question in this case is whether disparate impact claims, which permit liability based on disproportionate impact in the absence of express discriminatory intent, are allowed under the Fair Housing Act. To discuss the case, we have Honorable Todd F. Gaziano, who is the Executive Director the Washington, D.C. Center and Senior Fellow in Constitutional Law at the Pacific Legal Foundation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Honorable Gaziano.
I'm going to begin with describing some of the key issues. I'm not going to go into great detail. One of the other things I want to proudly disclose is that the Pacific Legal Foundation filed an amicus brief in this case and has filed an amicus brief in the preceding cases that were settled on the eve of oral argument. And that brief was not only for the Pacific Legal Foundation, but also from a lot of friends who a lot of us know, the Center for Equal Opportunity, Competitive Enterprise Institute, Cato Institute, Individual Rights Foundation, Reason Foundation, Project 21, and the Atlantic Legal Foundation. That brief was by my colleagues, Ralph Casarda, Miriam Hubbard, Joshua Thompson, and Wen Faw. So I want to give them credit for helping me get up to speed. But as I said before, I'll begin rehearsing a little bit of the issues that are pretty familiar to most of us in the Federalist Society. The narrow issue before the Supreme Court is whether the Federal Housing Act, which was first enacted in 1968 and amended in some ways that may or may not be consequential, but became a matter of great interest to the oral argument today, amended in 1988, allow only for a disparate treatment cause of action for intentional discrimination, or also the same language requires lenders, states, others who are involved in housing transactions, and that's housing insurers, for example, whether they are potentially liable for policies or actions or otherwise that have a disparate negative effect on some group. One of my colleagues at PLF, Wen Faw, had an excellent blog post on our Liberty blog raising the obvious point, what policy can man invent that doesn't have a disparate impact? So that's the narrow issue. But there are some larger issues at play. One must be honest, even if we are of the position that it is illogical to read the statute to allow a disparate impact claim, that every circuit court has held to the contrary, and there are now, I believe, 10 of them. There were 9 at the time Congress amended the statute in 1988. And the larger issues are whether any such disparate impact cause of action can survive constitutional scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause. As many of you know, that issue has arisen in a couple of contexts, but most frequently under Title VII. And most recently in the Ricci decision, Justice Scalia, in a concurrence, referred to the evil day, that was his words, for when the court would have to confront whether the disparate impact liability that the Supreme Court originally read into Title VII in 1971 in the Griggs case and later codified by Congress, but expressly codified by Congress in 1991, if I remember my year correctly, was constitutional. So the challengers of the disparate impact in all of the cases that had been pending in the Supreme Court and in the current case by the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs, said that first the statute in the Fair Housing Act unambiguously does not permit a disparate impact claim. And I'll touch on that in just a minute. The other side, of course, predictably said it unambiguously does allow a disparate impact, but if not, if it's ambiguous at all, then the Department of Housing and Urban Development is entitled to Chevron deference. But as a Federal Society law nerds know, there are many canons of construction. And step one of Chevron says you apply other canons of construction before you determine if there's an ambiguity. And one of the most powerful canons of construction is the canon of constitutional avoidance, first articulated by Chief Justice Marshall in 1833. And as we all know, the courts are directed to read a statute to avoid a constitutional question. It was originally a somewhat stronger canon, only to avoid, you know, grave constitutional doubts. But now courts are instructed to interpret a statute to avoid even a serious constitutional question. That's an interesting observation, you know, that how the court comes to that conclusion is very important, because if that is part of the analysis of this decision, which I think it ought to be, then we may get a view of more than one or two justices as to what the looming constitutional problem with any disparate impact analysis is. The constitutional avoidance canon, therefore, can make a statute unambiguously not present a constitutional problem, because it also contains a presumption. And that presumption is that Congress would not want to, knowing its constitutional limits, would not want to legislate close to the line. But the Supreme Court since 1988 has also explained in a couple of decisions that it trumps the Chevron deference canon of construction. So even if it doesn't by itself make a statute unambiguous, even if the statute remains ambiguous, if there's one interpretation of a statute that creates a serious constitutional question, the Supreme Court will choose that which avoids it. In this case, of course, the interpretation is of a statute that only prohibits intentional discrimination. Let's go through just a hypothetical or two, and I'll try to wrap up my prepared remarks in about 10 minutes after I talk about the oral argument. We have various lenders who use financial criteria to evaluate the borrower's ability to repay the home loan. But income and net worth, for that matter, are not, as we all know, perfectly evenly distributed. And there are many reasons for that. One of which is that different racial groups have different average ages, and person's sort of lifetime earning curve may shift for some racial groups versus others. So a disparate impact interpretation of a statute would make a financial institution liable if it applied race-neutral financial criteria, you know, income and net worth ratios compared to the size of the loan. And the only way that they might be able to avoid disparate impact liability is to give racial preferences or to significantly weaken financial criteria for everyone. But if they substantially weaken financial criteria for everyone, that's economically disastrous. That's what caused the housing crash. So and there isn't as much room for them to do that anymore, because they now face higher liability for unloading bad debt to people like Fannie and Freddie. So if this housing department regulations were upheld, financial institutions would be in a bind, but the only way to avoid disparate impact liability might be to grant preferences. But that is discriminating on the basis of race, which everyone agrees the Federal Housing Act prohibits. So the Department of Housing and Urban Development had a curious solution for that, that if you're acting to avoid disparate impact liability, you can engage in conscious race-conscious activity if it is legally justified. And as the state and some amici pointed out, that is a textual exception to liability. If disparate impact exists, it's absolute. There's no way to square the circle. And not only is it an atextual defense, this legally justifiable, but it's extremely subjective and circular, leaving it to any future government to define. So now that goes a little further than I thought I would in laying out the issues, let me tell you what I heard of the oral argument. Most of the justices fell into very predictable patterns, but we were probably most concerned to hear from Justice Kennedy, and Justice Kennedy only asked one question, and I'll mention that in a minute. What was concerning for those of us, or the only justice who didn't follow type, was Justice Scalia in one line of questioning involving the meaning of the 1988 amendments. The 1988 amendments made clear that there would not be liability, either disparate impact or disparate treatment, for certain types of conduct, including that of appraisers. And Justice Scalia seemed to advance an argument that the only way to understand those exclusions from disparate impact liability were to assume that Congress understood the underlying statute to create that liability. The Texas Solicitor General Keller tried to explain, and eventually was able to explain, that the amendments did something other than that. And Justice Alito twice tried to come to his aid, and Justice Alito made the sensible argument that if Congress was under a mistaken idea of the meaning of the 1968 Act in creating disparate impact liability, that could not in itself expand the scope of liability, and that the exceptions to liability that didn't exist doesn't do anything to create such liability. But Scalia came back in, and I don't have the transcript with me, so I'll have to rely on my notes, but Scalia said it could have essentially codified that you read the original text and the exceptions together, and if the only logical way to read the entire statute is to allow disparate impact liability, then Congress has in effect amended it to create disparate impact liability. Certainly Congress can amend a statute to create disparate impact liability that doesn't exist, but I think that eventually the Texas Solicitor General was able to give an argument as to why it was unreasonable to read the 1988 amendments that way. But Scalia's questioning in that, and there were one or two other areas that I've seen in blogs since the oral argument where Scalia was playing devil's advocate, I think, and didn't really indicate strongly which way his vote was going to go. The rest of the argument was fairly predictable. Both sides made textual arguments, including the argument that without effects language in Title VII, Title VII is written very differently than the Fair Housing Act, and was written with language that's strikingly similar to the ADEA, Section 4A1, which the Supreme Court unanimously found did not create disparate impact. Texas, in its brief, also, I think, interestingly, argued that the Supreme Court in 1971 was wrong to read even effects language as creating disparate impact liability. That wasn't repeated at oral argument today, but is in the background. There's a argument in the briefing, as many of you know, that if you want to keep, you know, that reading of certain statutes for stare decisis purposes, even though some of them have been now expressly codified to so hold, that's one thing. But the court should not extend an illogical argument that way. couple other points. Both sides did argue their strength on the side of the housing advocates, and the U.S. Solicitor General Verrilli argued for the government that relied on Chevron. The biggest last line, I think, of the day was when Justice Alito challenged Solicitor General Verrilli that maybe the regulations weren't entitled to Chevron deference because they were issued after the government settled cases before the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court was trying to decide this case. And Justice Verrilli said there were two reasons not to withhold Chevron deference to the regulations. The first was that it was a consistent position taken in formal adjudication since 1992. And the second was it was, he said, without being flip, too much to assume that the better argument for why the regulations came out when they did was government inefficiency. Alito seemed to accept, and others seemed to accept that answer, but that was the only reference during the oral argument to the two prior cases. On the constitutional doubt argument, which I think is very strong, in fact, I personally think that the Chief Justice has relied on the constitutional question canon often in cases like the Bond versus United States decision last year when it really was not ambiguous enough to use the constitutional doubt canon. But in this case, the Solicitor General made a valiant effort to explain why Scalia's concern about constitutional doubt might come into play in Title VII, where the remedies are typically, he didn't use the word zero-sum game, but that was the import. He said you're generally providing a remedy for one racial group, or any remedy you apply will have a different effect on a different racial group. But he argued that in the Fair Housing Act context, the remedies involved might be race conscious, but they were the kind of race conscious looks that Justice Kennedy seemed to be okay with in his parents' involved concurrence. And they don't require a sort of zero-sum game racial remedy. He was challenged on that, and appropriately so, I think, by the Chief Justice, if I remember correctly. But he said that if there are problems that are somewhat zero-sum game that come up in the Fair Housing Act context, those should be taken care of on an as-applied challenge. He seemed to say that there was no constitutional question with regard to the regulations on their face. My own view is the constitutional doubt canon, whether it comes into play or not, will probably still decide this case, but there's a few paths that the justices can take to avoid the constitutional avoidance canon. They can, if they receive Scalia's vote on the 1988 amendments, for example, they can say that the statute unambiguously allows a disparate impact cause of action, and that the statute or the regulations, disparate impact regulations, are not constitutionally suspect on their face. On the other hand, they could hold that the statute either unambiguously precludes a disparate impact because it's settled law under their ADEA decision in Smith, that the language that was used in the Fair Housing Act does not create a disparate impact cause of action and don't need to use constitutional doubt, but constitutional doubt canon would certainly augment that decision. I'll conclude with the only exchange that led to Justice Kennedy making a remark. And it was after the Chief Justice was hammering the Solicitor General Verrilli on whether the housing authority would be subject under the regulations disparate impact authority, whether they created housing to improve the revitalize an inner city neighborhood, which he said could be viewed as both good and bad, or built housing in the suburb, which could be attacked also as good or bad. Verrilli essentially, after trying to avoid the Chief Justice's question, said that yes, either could create a sort of potential for further analysis, but that a housing authority could prevail in both cases. And so Justice Kennedy asked his one and only question, which was, again, to sort of restate the hypothetical that in step one, a housing authority or other jurisdiction would be subject to disparate impact litigation in either case. Again, the Solicitor General really seemed to confer that, and he said that that seemed strange to him. So that's the only window we had today into Justice Kennedy's mind.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.